Good morning, everyone. Professor Jeffrey Swartz here with my compatriot, Professor Brendan Berry. We are both professors at WMU Cooley Law School's Tampa Bay campus. And I begin the show, as I always do, with the statement that the opinions set forth by Brendan and myself are our opinions only, and they are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of WMU Cooley Law School or its faculty at large. Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Jeff. How you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm sitting here on a deck outside of a house towards the top of Beech Mountain in North Carolina, looking out over this beautiful landscape and all the birds, and it's just sunshiny, and it's in the 60s, and it's just fabulous. I got to tell you, this is like, you know, like heaven. I haven't been this real, and I have my grandchildren around me, and I have Marilyn here, and Marilyn's children were here, and her grandchildren were here, and it's just been a fun old week and a half, and we still have a half a week to go. So it's fabulous up here, and the people are nice. It's terrific.
Can I come up there?
What?
Can
sure,
I come up
Brendan.
There? This sounds great.
It's about a 12-hour drive, but you're more than welcome.
Okay.
Okay. You can always fly. You can always fly into Charlotte and drive 3 hours from there.
Right.
It's your choice. I don't really care.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
If you want to spend a fortune, you can fly into Asheville. Okay. How's that sound?
Uh-huh.
That's only 45 minutes away. Okay. So it's magnificent. It's just been. I've played golf three or four times since I've been here. It's just great. Okay.
Nice.
I may actually like retirement. I'm not real sure. how you doing, Brent? You okay?
So yeah, talk about a contrast, right? Listening to Jeff and how am I doing? Well, I spent yesterday afternoon having wax dug out of my ears. How does that sound for a relaxing term break? And I still can't
TMI.
Hear.
TMI. TMI. Okay.
Right. Okay.
Wait a minute. Was this a segment of what you really think? This is a very
No, we haven't got there yet. Okay. There you go. How are you doing, Hesse? We might as well get it all in here. Are you doing okay over
well,
there?
I'm doing okay because I had my ears cleaned out a long time ago, and it's still holding.
Excellent.
So I feel good, but I'm commiserating with Brendan.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. That kind of works, I guess, sort of. Okay.
Yeah, so who's the grumpy one today, right? The last week it was you. Sounds
well,
like it's me today.
Maybe you, but I've been known to switch gears very quickly in my life, so we'll never know.
Yeah, right.
Okay. The way we start this show is that Brendan and I take a few minutes, and we talk about what we really think, and then basically we discuss between us what we really think and then move on to other subjects. On this particular day, I had a couple of things that I really wanted to go after, but one of them is a rather lengthy conversation that we'll have in the not-too-distant future, meaning sometime today. I want to talk what I really think is really a thought process involving and the lieutenant governor of the state of Texas. We have heard some absolutely ridiculous, horrendous, xenophobic thought processes regarding COVID-19 and the causes for it and why it's here in this country. We've heard it called the China virus. We've heard it called all kinds of racist names as we've gone through the last 2 years almost now. It's been almost 2 years, a year and a half, but going on 2 years, and it's going to be here 2-3 years anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But the lieutenant governor of the state of Texas really set me off. And we understand that Greg Abbott is a racist. We understand that the Texas legislature is racist. We understand that they are in serious difficulties because they're gaining seats and there's no way for them to gerrymander the ability to maintain a majority in the Texas delegation based upon the population growth in large cities, which is where they are attacking voter. They attack the big cities in the census. They attack the big cities in the voter suppression laws. That's what this is all about. But there are going to be new lines drawn in Texas, and we know that that's going to be a problem for Governor Abbott. We understand that the people of the state of Texas are not really represented by their legislature, and they're not really represented by Greg Abbott. But the lieutenant governor just took a step too far. In discussing the COVID-19 surge in the state of Texas, which is only surpassed by the state of Florida and moron DeSantis's thought processes, he decided to blame the unvaccinated black population of Texas as the cause of the surge. Not just unvaccinated people, unvaccinated black people. And it clearly was as racist a statement as you could possibly imagine. And it really comes in the idea that it's born out of his lack of understanding of the science or his chosen way to ignore the science. It's born out of that same situation that we have in Florida, which is the cynical sacrifice of your own citizens, your own children, because it's good for you politically to be able to point, and it's already started, pointing to Biden and saying, this is Biden's fault. He promised you he'd be rid of COVID-19 by the fall, and he was going to have everybody vaccinated. Well, not everybody's vaccinated, of course, ignoring the fact that they have been, for a very long time, diminishing the value of vaccines and feeding into the idea that people shouldn't be vaccinated. And the whole idea, the cynical idea that sacrificing those people leads them to the political promised land. In the case of Lieutenant Governor of Texas, he sees himself as the next governor of Texas. He believes that Greg Abbott is going to be a presidential candidate or he's going to be president of the United States, and he wants to be the next governor. So this is a joint thought process. His racist beliefs, his xenophobic thoughts are the problem. And the truth of the matter is that he is standing alone. He is in a league of his own when he goes after the black population and says, they're the reason. What we really need to do, and I think this is what this, I said this once before, if this Lieutenant Governor and Greg Abbott really are intent on seceding from the union, we should let them. And what they really want to do is get rid of all of the blacks and all of the Hispanics and form their own little white nation down. And to believe that they're not thinking those things, they're just wrong. Okay, you're just wrong if you don't believe this. These guys, this statement could not have been made without Greg Abbott knowing it was coming. It could not, it's impossible for the lieutenant governor to make statements like that when his boss doesn't know he's going to say it. And you didn't hear Greg Abbott step up and say, this is racist, this is unacceptable. Did you hear him step up and say those things?
No.
And demand resignation from his lieutenant governor. You didn't hear those things, did you? So you know full well that he endorses this thought process. And this thought process is completely unacceptable. And I can't believe that it has not become as big an issue as I thought it would when I first heard. It literally is just something that is just I can't even get angry about it. It's just kind of that anger, that incense that you get that just wells within you, and someday soon maybe it'll explode. But right now it needs talking about. And so to you, Lieutenant Governor of the state of Texas, I say you should resign. I think you should go back and become the Grand Wizard of your Ku Klux Klan chapter, okay, and leave us alone. And that's what I think.
Yeah, you know, the Republican Party at this point has abandoned the dog whistle for the bullhorn. Did you ever hear the statement of Lee Atwater? He was caught once in a moment of candor. So Lee Atwater was the chief strategist for George Bush Sr., George H.W. Bush, one of the early 30 tricksters.
I tried to forget him, and now you're bringing him back up again.
Yeah.
I tried to forget him, and you're bringing him back up. Okay, thanks.
Okay. Yeah, but before he died of brain cancer, some time ago, he did leave us with an interesting explanation of racist politics. During one conversation that he thought he was giving, you know, one of these deep background, I think at one point during the recording, he actually even says, you know, I hope nobody's recording this, something like that. He went on to explain
That's
now, you know, part of the, obviously part of the recorded record. So it's difficult to listen to this conversation because it has awful, awful language in it. But he's talking about how when he and his sort try to engage in racist appeals, they try to do it at a level of abstraction where they have plausible deniability. And he used some examples. For example, we'll talk about certain economic programs that would hurt black people more than white people, or we talk about busing, or we talk about that kind of thing. And you reach a level of abstraction where white people know what you're talking about, but you can plausibly deny that you're being a racist because you didn't explicitly target anybody based on their ethnicity. And what's been interesting to watch here is that, by the way, that conversation comes up. If you were to Google the term dog whistle politics, that conversation will come up in your Google search as an explanation of what is meant by dog whistle politics, that a politician is saying something that the politician knows is racist. All the white people in the audience know everybody knows is racist, but can deny that it has anything to do with race. They've simply moved away from that, and now they're explicit about it. You know, even Lee Atwater thought, well, you can't just come out and say it. You know, you have to couch it in terms where you can't be accused of being a racist. You have to, as he put it, reach a level of abstraction where you can deny your true motives. When it comes to the age of Trump, as I say, it's no longer a dog whistle; it's a bullhorn. They just come right out and say it. And you're right. This guy Dan Patrick, the lieutenant governor of Texas, he didn't use a dog whistle. He just came out and said it.
He came out and said it. I've been looking at this and I try to forget Atwater because the whole idea of a Southern strategy, although not invented by him, was played by him in so many different ways. His attitude was Reagan didn't need to use it simply because race wasn't a dominant issue when Reagan ran. And second, the mainstream issues in the campaign had been Southern issues since way back in the 60s. So whatever Reagan was saying, it was addressed to whites in the South without having to say, this is my Southern strategy. Recently, Trump used a Southern strategy. He wanted that solid block of states from Louisiana through Florida and up to North Carolina, and including Tennessee. That whole block of the Southeast was to be his, and he felt he could ride that in the Midwest to victory. But the attitudes that Atwater used really came out, as you said, over the use of the N-word. He thought that he was upset that in the 14 years from 1954 to 1968, you weren't allowed to use the N-word. Whereas in the South, they used the N-word constantly as a dog whistle, okay, for whites to get out and vote. So I agree with you. But the fact that, that Dan Patrick, and please, for Dan Patrick, the sportscaster, I'm really sorry you have to share that name. okay, because Dan Patrick was a great sportscaster. I'm sorry the name is just shared. I just cannot imagine thoughts like this really permeating within a pandemic. I just think it's awful. And I'm using, you know, I can't even use the words that I really want to use, so I'll just drop it at that. But Atwater is a perfect example that really put together that whole Southern strategy. And Republicans have used it ever since. Most people don't understand, you know, where that came from. It came from Lyndon Johnson and the Voting Rights Act. All of those senators, they were solidly Democrat. They were known as Blue Dogs. And, you know, when Lyndon Johnson passed the Voting Rights Act, Strom Thurmond said, Democrats will never win another election in the South, ever.
Mm-hmm.
That was his attitude, okay? And he hasn't been all that wrong.
No,
right. I know it goes back over 50 years, almost 60 years now, but he wasn't all that wrong. So, So what are you thinking about these days?
So we talked last week about the operation that's going on in Kabul, and we agreed that the United States should do everything it can to get its allies out, that we owed it to them, as you put it. We've made a deal, with, and you keep your word. And the initial reports, obviously, and scenes, really, it's often in politics and even geopolitics about the optics. the initial scenes of Afghans running after airplanes that were departing, were heartbreaking and painted the picture of an unfolding humanitarian disaster, which, by the way, is still going to unfold. I'll talk more about that in a minute. But in the week since, I just checked the numbers this morning. What's the media? Well, let me start with this point. The mainstream media already has its narrative, and it's not going to depart from its narrative. They decided that this was their opportunity to go after Joe Biden. They decided they love nothing more than to watch and, if necessary, create the fall of a political leader. And so they've got their opportunity, and they've decided that the narrative here is going to be that this is a disaster. It's Joe Biden's fault. That's the narrative. I don't think I've seen any really mainstream media outlets depart from that narrative yet. We'll see if they do. There are commentators and individuals on certain networks who have departed from that narrative. But when you just look at the general theme running through the coverage, that's the narrative that has emerged. Now, since we last spoke, 60,000 people have been evacuated from Afghanistan. The White House announced this morning that in the last 24 hours, 22,000, in one 24-hour period, 22,000 people have been evacuated from Kabul because of dozens and dozens of flights on board U.S. C-17 transport aircraft and the C-130s as well. There was one now famous flight. There's a photograph, I'm sure everybody's seen it, of Afghan now refugees on board of one of our C-17 aircraft. And the original reports were that there were 640 people on that flight. Since then, the flight crew has... The flight crew has corrected that and said that didn't count the 183 children that were on board. 640 was only the adults on board. Apparently there was an incident with military air traffic control where Jeff, you have a son who's involved in the military, so you're probably more familiar with this lingo than I am. But apparently, when a military aircraft takes off, they have to report to air traffic control, quote unquote, souls on board.
Yes.
Right. And the pilot of the C-17 was asked by the air traffic controller to report on souls on board. And he said over 800. And that prompted the air traffic controller to actually drop the F-bomb over the military airways, saying, holy F. Now, so far, and I don't want to get ahead of myself. I don't want any of us to get ahead of ourselves. This is going to, it's still going to be messy. There are still going to be absolute, there already have been, tragedies and travesties. But so far, this has been probably, logistically, one of the most successful airlift evacuations in military history. It's at least trending in that direction. And so far, there has not been a shot fired. Jeff and I talked about this earlier this morning. That probably has something to do with the Taliban, who, by the way, met with the CIA director recently, just yesterday, I guess, that they understand the consequences that would rain down on them if an American is to be harmed during this operation. As Jeff said last week, the Taliban wants us to go away. And the best way for them to get us to just go away is to let us leave with everybody we want, right? Without incident. And then, okay, then they can do what they're going to do to that country. In the meantime, if harm does come to an American during this operation, and Jeff and I always talk before we come on, and I had floated the question whether we have an aircraft carrier parked nearby. It turns out we have two. The Fifth Fleet is within striking distance of Afghanistan, and it has been joined by a second carrier strike group led by the USS Ronald Reagan, and that those warships are positioned to strike at any time. It would take, a matter of minutes to identify where Taliban leadership is and to flatten it. I just wanted to sort of point that, so what I'm really thinking is the media needs to get its act together. I'm not saying not to criticize Joe Biden. I'm not saying not to criticize the way this started. I'm not saying that the administration was fully prepared the way it should have been. But when I used the word piling on last week, and it has gotten to the point of the absurd. And again, I sense, maybe I'm wrong on this, but I sense this constant urge on the part of media types to achieve false equivalents, to bring everybody to the same level, to cover Joe Biden the same way they covered Donald Trump, when in fact they're two completely different animals. We have to
literally
get away from the clickbait. We're going to hear a lot of anecdotes here. That's what I'm predicting. We're going to hear a lot of anecdotes about, I saw one yesterday on CNN. I think it was their lead story for a while, that the brother of a translator had been murdered. We're going to see tragic stories. So newsflash, that's what happens in wars. If you don't want to see tragic stories, then don't start one. I'm going to give Joe Biden credit here for something. I heard another commentator say this, but it really struck me. You know what? It's kind of easy if you're a president of the United States, like let's say George W. Bush. It's kind of easy to start a war. It's politically popular. You're always going to have people cheering you on when you start a war. You know what's hard? What's really hard? You know what's really a difficult decision to make is the decision to end one and to take on the consequences of that yourself. For that, Joe Biden deserves credit.
He does.
I got to ask you one question.
Yeah.
I don't understand why the media wants to blame the president, Joe Biden. Shouldn't we be looking at the military industrial complex who promoted all of this for all these years?
Well,
are we getting the right amount of information in order to be able to make a credible move forward one way or the other?
Go ahead, Hezzy.
Well, where's the expertise? You know, where's the military expertise?
Let me put.
That's what I wonder.
All right. Well, here's and that was going to be my next comment. You're leading right into it. First of all, Biden's taking. No, it's fine. It's a good question. Biden is taking the hit because of how messy it's been. He's taking the hit because of probably either the intelligence failures or his failure to listen to the intelligence and the military people who were saying, you know, we're getting out of here before we're getting our people out of here, and that's not making sense. So to a certain extent, I think that there is some blame on his part for why things have been as messy as they've been. Now, let's not forget, okay, that we drew down from, I think, over 50,000 to 2,500 after Trump signed this so-called agreement with the Taliban, who started with the thought process right at that point of saying, Americans have the clocks. We have the time. Mm-hmm. And so they laid low to a great extent. They did not force the issue because they knew they were going to be able to do it as soon as the Americans were gone. And as a result of which, they were down to 2,500 people to evacuate thousands of Americans, tens of thousands of Afghans whose either were family of or were in fact interpreters or people who had cooperated with the Americans in helping hold back the Taliban for years, knowing full well that the Taliban would go looking for them and behead them in front of their families, and maybe even behead their families in front of them first. So it's one of those things where, and so Stephen Miller was actually put in charge. Remember Stephen Miller, the Jewish Nazi?
I remember.
Okay, right. Stephen Miller actually was put in charge of making sure these Afghans that we should be protecting were not allowed to get out of the country. We're not allowed to leave, and we weren't going to take them out. They weren't going to get visas. We weren't going to let Muslims into our country. Mm-hmm. And so he was put in charge of that. So when the agreement was made that we would be out by May 1st, which, of course, we weren't because Biden unilaterally said it's going to be August 31st, and I now think it's going to be more like October 31st. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where he had a choice. He could either ramp things up and send another 25 or 30,000 Americans in there, or he could just get out pursuant to the terms of the agreement. Biden thought we should have been out of there 10 years ago. Probably wasn't wrong. He was against the surge in 14, or was it 14? Yeah, I think it was 2014, yeah. Whatever it was that the surge that took place. I think it was 2014. He was against it. He was publicly against it. Everybody knew he was against it, but being the good soldier he was, he supported the administration once the decision was made. It is one of those things where, you know, he was very intent that this war had to come to an end, and had been for a very long time. And many politicians said the same thing. I mean, he wasn't new. The difference was he was a politician that was ready to literally, I guess figuratively, pull the trigger and take us out of there. So that the military, I don't think, was really – Milley and his people probably clearly – saw that their 2,500 people were in danger. That I think that there's no question about that. The failure was earlier in the State Department before Biden took office of not being able to get their ducks in a row, find out the Americans who were there, get them out earlier than this. There are Americans who are still insisting on staying. They don't want to leave. They're married to Afghani citizens, and they're comfortable there. They don't think they'll be okay. But I don't think they will be, but they think they will be. That's the failure here. That's the huge failure here. And so you have to go back all the way to Bush, who did what he wanted when he couldn't get Osama bin Laden up in Tora Bora, and we didn't know where he was. Get out of Afghanistan. Sooner or later, we'll find him.
Right.
And that's what it should have happened. But instead of that, he doubled down and he stayed in Afghanistan and went to Iraq too.
Right.
Okay. All right. So you want to blame people, blame George and Dick Cheney.
Right.
And then work your way through. Obama was wrong. He wanted to get out. He never did anything to get out. Trump said he was going to get out, but he tried to do it as a sideshow. Okay. He's going to bring the Taliban to Camp David. I mean, seriously?
Right.
Okay. Because they all love him. What was he thinking? Trump Towers Kabul or something? I don't know. But it's one of those things that you have to look at. And so I think to a great extent, they are failing. Now, I personally feel there's 6,000 there. We'll be lucky if it doesn't reach 15,000 before this little operation is over.
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Where we're going to have to send in people to literally create corridors and take over security around the airport and tell the Taliban, get the hell out of here so we can get our people through. And sooner or later, there's going to be one so-and-so who either doesn't agree with the message or doesn't have gotten the message, don't hurt Americans. And some American is going to die. And when that happens, Biden has no choice but to retaliate, no choice at all. And that retaliation has to be huge, and he knows that
right.
too. There's too many things that can go wrong here. Way, 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 way too many. And the real tragedy is going to be the refugee camps that are going to be set up for all of these Afghanis before we find places for them to go. Watch that start to happen. So there's a lot there that hasn't happened, that more likely than not is going to happen.
Right.
And it becomes disturbing. It's not the military's fault. We have civilian control over the military. Don't blame them. If there was an intelligence failure, I promise you, the heads will roll.
Yeah. Well, the 2 points. One is that you're right. The military is obviously doing an unbelievable job. The operations of which our military is capable is just breathtaking. Equipment that they have.
It truly is.
Secondly, to your point, that's why I'm expecting naturally that Republicans will go after Joe Biden. Apparently it was on his orders that the head of the CIA met with the leader of the Taliban in Kabul. It is absolutely critical that those types of meetings take place because the reality is the Taliban has taken over and the reality is we have to keep them away from our people. And the more direct the communication lines, so the more open those lines of communication, the better. So I hope we're not going to hear Republicans coming after the administration for opening up lines of communication, especially as you say, when Donald Trump wanted to have a photo op at Camp David with the Taliban. So I guess he would frame a picture of that next to his picture of himself hugging Kim Jong-un, right?
Legitimizing people all over the place.
Yeah, right.
What would he have done if they had handed him one of those turbans that they wear and asked him to put it on for the photo op? I want you to think about that for a second, laugh your ass off, and then we'll move on, okay? Okay.
God. Well.
Okay. I mean, only I could think of that, right?
That's only you. Oh, God. But here's as long as I'm venting. Here's a couple more issues. Number one, now you're starting to hear this ridiculous nonsense out of people like Lindsey Graham that Biden ought to resign or be impeached over this.
Yeah.
I want to
preface what you're about to say with the idea that Lindsey Graham, okay, after the election, called up Joe Biden and asked for his forgiveness for all the nasty things he said about his son, during the campaign.
Yeah,
why? Because
right.
Biden won and he wanted to suck up. Okay. Mm-hmm. So now he's saying, I finally found something bad I can say about you. I think you're senile. Get the hell out of there. Okay. Or
right.
we're gonna impeach you and put you through a mental examination. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Go.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, seriously, you know, sorry. Okay. Get a life. You never had one before, but maybe in your senior years you can have one, Lindsey Graham. Okay, but I mean, seriously, but go ahead. I'm sorry. I had to get that
out. That's good. But there's, you know, there's – I'm constantly, I don't know, I in awe of the – as I always say, of the ability of Republicans to turn reality on its head. And as I say, you know, it's like in their world, everything is its own opposite. Impeachment and removal from office is the kind of thing that you reserve for corruption and scandal. Mistakes do not constitute corruption and scandal. You know, the fact that Joe Biden, and again, we can all agree, that the first few days of this, after the collapse of the Afghan government and the collapse of the Afghan military, the first few days of this were not handled well. That's not a scandal. It's called what happens when humans are in charge, right? There are going to be mistakes. Things are going to go badly, especially in a theater like Afghanistan. Now, secondly, so first of all, you don't talk impeachment and removal because you think the person who's holding power made a mistake, a misjudgment.
Well, wait. I want to stop you there. I'm going to stop you there for a second. Republicans will say that you impeach Trump for making mistakes. The difference is that Trump didn't make mistakes. He just got caught. His mistake was he got caught.
It was misdeeds, not mistakes.
I know, but his mistake was he got caught.
Yeah, right. Right. Yeah,
okay.
For his misdeed. Right.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think
okay.
Right. All right. Okay, go ahead.
Right. Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
But and now finally, believe it or not, finally I'm going to come around to a constitutional point.
Good, finally.
Since we sometimes call this the Constitution today.
Right.
If members of Congress, I don't care, of either party, are going to stand on the sidelines and take pot shots at Joe Biden, the constitutional question is, where have you been, Congress? There's a famous line from, I never really got into that show, The West Wing, but there was one line that struck me from it, where the president is upstairs playing pool with his chief of staff, and his chief of staff is sort of taking some shots at some of his recent decisions. And the president throws down his pool stick and says, "How's the view from the cheap seats?"
That was the American president. No, that was
American
president.
Excellent. Right.
Martin Sheen was in both. Okay.
Yeah, it's very confusing all these president shows, but the point, right? The point is a good one, and so how about that, Lindsey Graham or anybody else who wants to take pot shots? In our constitutional system, there is a role for Congress. Congress is the one that's supposed to declare wars. Congress is the one that's supposed to raise armies and navies. Congress is the one that's supposed to make the rules for governing those who serve in the armed forces. Congress can authorize the president to do something. Congress can pass a resolution saying they don't want the president to do something. There are constitutional cases in which the Supreme Court has said if Congress shows that it disapproves of what the president's doing, that makes it much less likely that the president is constitutionally authorized to do it, because after all, the president is the chief executive. The president's job is to execute the law. It's Congress's job to make the law and to set policy. Congress has been completely absent and it has abdicated its role in our tripart government.
That's
so
true.
It rings a little disingenuous for the Lindsey Grahams of the world now to be standing on the sidelines, again, taking pot shots. Where's the legislation that you proposed, Lindsey Graham, where's the resolution you proposed about how we should handle Afghanistan? These people act like it's up to the president.
But there's the other step, and the other step is that the president of the United States is in charge of foreign policy.
Yes.
The foreign policy that the president of the United States said is that we're going to end our involvement in Afghanistan. That's his power. You gave him that power. You gave him the power to go. You can't take away the power to leave. And so as a result of which, this is a foreign policy decision. That's what people argue, and I happen to agree with it, that it's a foreign policy decision, and that is explicitly the power of the executive in the United States Constitution.
It depends. I mean, yes and no. I mean, again, the Congress explicitly has the power to declare war. War making is not reserved to the president. And courts have always recognized some role for Congress if Congress decides to exercise its power, and it hasn't.
Right.
So here we are. So instead, they're just
great. I agree with that. But it is a matter of war, but the problem is, this is not a war. This is an undeclared war.
Well, there you go. Right.
Okay. And so, as a result of which, it's a foreign policy decision.
That's what we've devolved to.
We've given because our and to a certain extent, some of this power has to be delegated because. Every time the president has to act, and one of his major things to do is to defend the United States of America and Americans everywhere. And so, as a result of which, he has to have the power to take some military action to defend the United. I mean, if there are missiles coming, he doesn't have power to consult with Congress as to whether he should fire back. That's a decision he has to make. So to an extent, he has this power to defend, and that was the basis of going to Afghanistan in the first place, defending the United States of America against its enemies. Okay, we're going to go over there. We're going to wipe out that enemy because that's my job as president of the United States. And I think, if I'm not wrong, I think Bush specifically made that justification when he spoke to the American people.
But he did? He got authorization from Congress.
Yeah, he did.
Called the
authorization. Hung around for 20 years. 20 years he's used with presidents have used that authorization to do whatever they want to do in the Middle East.
Right.
Okay. That's their authority. If Congress doesn't like it, then take it away. Set it aside. There are people that have made and set forth bills to repeal that authorization.
Yeah.
Go ahead and do it. If you think you're smarter. But the problem is they don't want the responsibility. They want the guy at the top to carry the responsibility. They don't want it. That's too much like work.
Right.
That's too much like doing the job you were elected to do.
Right. Yeah. There was an episode during the Obama administration. In my memory, Obama's the only one who ever called their bluff on this. Members of Congress wanted Obama to start a war in Syria because you remember the whole famous crossing the red line.
The red line, don't cross the red line, yeah.
Right, and look, Obama should never have used that language, blah, blah, blah. But members of Congress wanted Obama to start a war over that. And Obama said, go ahead and authorize me, you Congress, you give me go ahead and authorize me to start a war, and I will. And they didn't. And he knew they wouldn't for exactly the reason you just said. They didn't want the responsibility.
Right. They don't want the responsibility. And we understand that. So, I mean, we just have to accept that, they're the cowards. Okay. Don't think that anybody else is the coward. They're the cowards. So you can leave it at that. The last thing I wanted to talk about today, and we only have about 15 minutes, and boy, we'll kill 15 minutes with this one. I said last – we can kill 3 hours with this one. I announced last week on this show that I considered what we refer to as the far right, these militant militia, anti-vaxxers to a great extent. A huge percentage of them, people who won't wear masks, that type of thing, as being the American Taliban. And some people have questioned my use of those words. And so I'm going to tell you why I feel this way, and then we can discuss it a little bit. I see anti-vaxxers to a great extent, people who are fighting mask mandates and arguing freedom, 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 okay? No different than the Taliban who say we should be free to run our country under Sharia law, okay, and men should be dominant, that type of thing. It's an ideology. And they both work off of this extreme ideology. They both follow a similar religious fervor. To the Taliban, it is their interpretation of the Quran, which, if you've ever read it, and I've read portions of it, I will tell you, don't say the things that they claim that it says. Any more than sometimes, I don't think, in their religious fervor here, the conservative right and its evangelical leaders, and I do consider some evangelical preachers to be leaders of the far right, argue certain things in the Bible, say, sir, that they interpret the Bible in a way to support their authoritarian thought processes. The thing that really irks me is when they start interpreting the Old Testament. Okay, that's my book. Okay? That's my book. Okay, you didn't like my book. You wrote your own book. Okay? You want to interpret your book. I have no expert on that. But those first five books, they belong to me. Okay? And as a result of which, you know, don't tell me what they say. I went to Saturday school and I went to Hebrew school and I learned what they said. You don't need to tell me what they say. And so, you know, keep that to yourself. But the bottom line is that they do these things. They interpret their religion to solidify both sides, to solidify their beliefs, and bring people together to give them a commonality. They each demand that people follow them. That if you don't follow them, you are evil. They both want to control women. In the case of the American Taliban, even the women participate in this subjugation. Both ignore science. Both see most of their own populations as a threat. Both see the press as the enemy of the people, freedom of the press. Both follow a single leader and all but worship that leader as a savior, almost a god. Both are xenophobic. If you're not like me, you don't belong here. And mostly both are minorities. And the Taliban is a minority. They got the guns, but they're a minority. They are minorities intent on using force to overrule a quiet, subjugated majority. Now, tell me where this isn't the far right. Not conservatives. They're not conservatives. They're alt-right. They are, for all intents and purposes, although we revile the name Nazi, they are Nazis. They believe in fascism. How are they different than what we're seeing in Afghanistan? Tell me the difference between the American Taliban and the Afghani Taliban, and I'll be more than happy to listen. This is just what we are living right now. This is our country right now. We have an insurgency going on in our country. Not an insurrection. We had that. This is an insurgency trying to undermine our foreign government to subjugate other people because the majority or the people that are trying to destroy the government are white, and they don't want anybody who's not white having anything to do with our government. Tell me the difference, and I'm more than happy to listen.
Right. Well, it's, you know, again, this whole idea, it's the same people who you're talking about, the American alt-right, are the ones who make the most noise about, yeah, quote-unquote freedom and spreading freedom around the world. Not only do many people around the world not yearn for freedom, I talked about this last week, there are plenty of people on this planet who are authoritarians, both the leader and the led. So not only do many people around the world not yearn to be free, but the Americans who are saying that, who are part of the alt-right, they don't yearn to be free either. It is strictly an authoritarian approach, authoritarian thinking, and it is difficult to differentiate. You know, I don't know. Again, it always comes back to every time we discuss folks who associate themselves with this kind of thinking, it always comes back to this point that you wouldn't believe it if it wasn't really happening. The CDC, as you and I discussed earlier, had to issue a statement telling people on the alt-right that they should stop taking horse deworming medicine as a cure for COVID-19. And you have to ask yourself, how does a person get themselves into an intellectual space where this sounds reasonable, right, to you? I will not take a vaccine that is approved by the FDA, whether emergency or permanent basis. I won't. But when I get COVID-19, I will take horse deworming medicine because I read somewhere that that's a cure for COVID-19, right?
I can answer that for you. Okay?
Excellent.
They're the same people that I went to college with who used to take a thing called Sopers, which were actually hog tranquilizers to get high. Okay? So there you go. Okay, I can explain this to you, okay? You didn't think I could do that, did you? Okay.
No. You got me there. Never heard of that one. Although I'm not surprised, right? People would do anything. That's, you know. But
here, take a Sofer. A swine tranquilizer. It'll really feel great. Okay.
Right. And a horse dewormer. I know. So, yeah, so the CDC puts out, what was the exact tweet? It said, you're not a horse or a cow.
No. It just said, seriously, y'all, stop it. That's what the CDC put out when they explained. When they said, you're not a horse, okay, don't take this medicine. Seriously, y'all, stop it.
Y'all, right. Now, isn't it interesting? The choice of that term, y'all, was an interesting choice. I think they knew who they were addressing.
Yeah, they sure did.
Yeah.
I read that tweet and I said, it can't possibly have come from the CDC. And I looked at it and it came right from the CDC.
Yep.
I whoever wrote that should be given a promotion. I'm sorry. They should be made the director of communications, okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, seriously, y'all, stop that. Okay. Okay, one last thing I wanted to throw out here news-wise, which is it feeds into other stuff. Okay. Do we all remember Lev Parnas?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And his buddy Igor.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Furman. Okay. you remember these guys, right? And not many people know about Igor. I mean, they remember the name Igor was in there. Okay,
right. Lev and Igor.
They probably thought they were watching Frankenstein or something. But the name Igor was in there. But Lev Parnas was very public about all of this. I mean, he gave interviews. You know, he talked about all the money that was going back and forth, and what a bad guy Rudy Giuliani was, and all the things that go with it. Well, apparently these two have now reached accord with the federal government on the charges for which they were indicted. And now apparently it is reported by the New York Times and other places, okay, that there is a cooperation agreement that is part of this plea agreement. Now, I don't know about you, but I honestly believe that if I were Rudy Giuliani, I'd be thinking about trying to find, you know, moving to Honduras where there's no extradition.
Right.
Okay. There's not. I mean, everybody thinks you go to Panama. Now, Panama gives them up, and so does Brazil now, by the way. But Honduras is not a signatory to the Hague Convention, which is extradition and that type of thing, and you know, enforcing of judgments. And if I were him, I would take what little and actually just collect your Social Security, and you can live like a king in Honduras on Social Security. Okay, he doesn't need to have, you know, and they won't be able to collect their money from him because Honduras does not honor judgments. Okay, so, you know, you can get all the billion-dollar judgments you want. I don't know about you, but if I were him, I'd be gone already because he's going to die in prison. He hasn't seen the worst of the charges against him. He's going to die in prison. And Igor, and if I were any of the other people involved in the Trump campaign who had any contact with these guys, including Trump, remember all the photographs of these guys together?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'd be really nervous. I'd be very, very nervous. I mean, I remember Parnas telling us that everything that everybody was saying about Ukraine and Trump and Giuliani was absolutely true. And so I would just, I don't know. I just, to me, you know, you get something like this, you try to figure out a way to be able to bust your bail, okay, and find an airplane and find your way down to Honduras before anybody knows you're gone. And that would be fine with me. You know, I don't really need him to go to prison. I mean, living in Honduras would be a prison of its own. But you know, if I were, you know, or you know, maybe you go off to Ukraine, not Ukraine, Belarus.
Wow.
You know, you go to Belarus. I mean, you'd be a hero in Belarus. Okay. This guy's your kind of guy. Levashenko's your kind of guy. Okay. You know, he forces airplanes down and gets mad because,
yeah.
An Olympian says something bad about her coach. Okay, so you know they take their Secret Service and try to take her to the airport. That went real well. So that's kind of my thought process. So I think we need to pay attention to what's going on with these two guys because it's just, you know, one more notch in the belt and building a case. You know, another building block toward building a case. So. You know, let's get rid of Giuliani, and I still think Giuliani's going to fold like a cheap suit. Somewhere along here, that's what's going to happen. But
yeah,
that's kind of my projection, so we'll see what happens. What are your closing thoughts?
I think the only other thing that's in the news is that the Pfizer vaccine has now been permanently, I suppose, fully approved by the FDA instead of on an emergency basis. Couple questions about that. I've been fielding questions about mandates. In light of that approval, of course, President Biden has asked private businesses to impose mandates. And once again, this is raising the question, can private businesses impose mandates, right? Make it a condition of your employment that you have a shot, because apparently a lot
is
more private actors
question?
Now. Yeah,
it
shouldn't
question?
Be, right? If only everybody listened to our program, they'd all know the answer to that question, that a private business cannot violate the United States Constitution. The U.S. Constitution is, the way I always put it, it's a speed limit sign directed, you know, that's facing the government, right? It's not facing the rest of us. It's addressed to the government. It's the rules for how the government goes about its business. So absolutely, there's no constitutional issue with private businesses mandating that their employees be vaccinated. I guess the only other question is, since so many anti-vaxxers were using the FDA, right, the lack of FDA full approval as their excuse why they were not getting the vaccine, is how many of them are going to turn around and get the vaccine now. And here's my prediction: none. Right.
Yeah.
If you're an anti-vaxxer and your excuse was, well, the FDA hasn't approved this. Watch how many of these people go get the vaccine now that the FDA has approved it. I predict it'll be none. I don't think
it will be none, because just like they had to abandon all the dates that Trump was going to be reinstated.
Right.
Okay. And Mo Brooks tried to get. By the way, I just want to point this out. Mo Brooks at the Trump rally tried to give that one up and said we need to move on and think about 22 and 24, and he was booed off the stage.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Right. And this was his district. And he's running for the United States Senate. So I just want you to think about that.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
You know, gentlemen, unfortunately, we're going to have to come to a conclusion.
You've got to go on.
Yeah. Yep.
We'll have to save this till next week.
Okay.
Sounds good.
All right.
There'll be more.
Hezzy was wonderful. There'll be a lot more going on. Hezzy, have a wonderful
Absolutely.
Day. I'm glad that you're doing well.
Thank you.
Take
and
care.
All the best to you guys. Thank you very much.
All right.
Bye-bye,
be well.
Friend.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye, Hezzy. Bye-bye.
Okay, well, there we are, and we're going to move on to our next guests. And so, good morning, everybody. It looks like we have a lot of people here on the line. We are definitely going to have Tony Smith, who is the co-founder of the BSA Consulting Group, and Laughlin Arts, who speaks to the State of the Union. It's a citizen engagement campaign effort. So we're going to learn about all of that. Then we have a third caller as well. And I'm not sure who's who. So let's just say hello and good morning. Thanks for calling. Oh, hold on a minute. I made a mistake. I forgot to pull these people in. So bear with me a moment. That's my fault. Bear with me. Now we're pulling them everybody in. Well, good morning, gentlemen, and ladies, maybe.
Good morning
to you.
Well, you
good
know.
Good morning.
Maybe. Hi. Good morning, all. Well, you know, maybe we could get a semblance of the relationship here. So let's start off maybe with Tony Smith, because I have him first on the list here. He's the co-founder of the VSA Consulting Group. And what is your expertise? Because there's a tremendous amount of complexity to the language that you used, which is really fascinating. I think I had to read it twice, maybe three times. I'm not quite sure. But I believe that I've been able to comprehend the gist of it all. So I was hoping that we could unpack some of that, the integrity of the words used. So what is the intent of the VSA group and what you intend to do in the State of the Union?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Yes, we can hear
you all.
Okay,
great. Thank you. And good morning, and good to be on your show. I'm on with Laughlin Arts, who's the founder of 2030orBust.org, and that's why we're on the show. Hezzy, what I do at VSA Consulting Group is I basically transform executives into leaders and the culture into one that can work together at a different level. And the result is that their performance, financially included, goes way outside of expectation. So, that you could call that breakthrough coaching if you'd like. And that's what I do for a living. But my senior commitment after meeting Laughlin, I've really gotten clear with myself that, you know, all of what I can bring and he can bring and others can bring to climate crisis is where it's most needed. And so that's why we reached out to you. And Laughlin, I'm sure, will share about a State of the Union tour he's doing. Our premise, mm-hmm. Hezzy, is that the individuals taking a stand, us individuals, Hezzy, Tony, Laughlin, the people on this call, taking a stand for what they can do in their own lives and for the dropping of emissions by one-third by 2030, will allow us to live life with some semblance of joy and normality. And basically, we really do have a hard stop in these next 9 years. And it's not starts in 9 years. It starts now. And our thrust is to disabuse people of the notion that somebody else is handling it, the government's handling it, the Green Deal is New Green Deal's handling it, the Paris Accords or Bill Gates. It's really going to come down to individuals standing up, as it always has been since the beginning of this country. And if we don't stand up, it's not going to turn out so well. And 2030orbust.org is committed to ring that bell and also provide a platform where individuals can get in action in their own lives. Literally, what are you doing in your own life consistent with dropping your carbon footprint? And there are things that can be done. And if we go...
These are all very compelling thoughts, and I guess the thing that's fascinating is that a lot of people are exceptional in the subject matter that they're engaged in, but you're able to, through your concepts, to ratchet up the intensity and the integrity of the issue, which is climate change. So let's find out a little bit more as well from Lachlan Art, and he's part of the State of the Union engagement campaign that you're involved in. So explain a little bit of that as well.
Okay. Thank you. And, you know, as Tony said, thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to be with you and your listeners.
Sure.
And just as a little bit of background, and then I'll address specifically the State of the Union. You know, I had no intention ever to get into anything about climate change, ever. And, you know, I don't like science. I was not that good at it, you know, ever. And but about 5 years ago, I did get interested, and I was working as a journalist, and I got, let's do some stories on climate change. And the question I wanted to ask, which I thought was what anybody on the street would want to know, is how long do we have until the crap really hits the fan? And I started talking to the experts that I had the opportunity of, some of these people I worked with in previous projects, and got all the way up to the Assistant Secretary General of the UN. And when I asked him, he said, well, it's probably too late. And this was 5 years ago.
Really?
And I was like, wow. I mean, that was like a real game stopper for me, or whatever you call it, right? Like, wow, right? One, if that was actually the case, and the other, that I was so ill-informed. And so I really stopped doing what I was...
You're not the
only
one, are you?
No.
If it was the end of the line 5 years ago, and it's, we're already 5 years too late...
Yes.
What do we do?
So, I know, and that was my whole thing, right? So then I just stopped what I was doing, and I started going to all these conferences, and the question I kept asking was, what are we going to do? What has to happen? And I couldn't get the answers. And I started to see that all of this wonderful work that's being done, and it is amazing work that the UN is doing, and it is amazing work that the government is doing, and the billionaires and science, and people are doing amazing, amazing things, but what you don't hear people talking about is what's the gap between everything that we're doing and what we have to do to actually end the crisis in time. What is that specific gap? How long do we have? What are the actions that have to be taken? And who's going to take those actions? And so that's where 2030 or Bust came in. And we said, we are going to make the gap.
So what we realize now is that this is all coming from the top and supposedly going down, but
yes,
the public is not involved or engaged in any way.
Not involved.
Is that because they feel impotent in knowing what to do, even though we may be scared by what Greta Thunberg tells us, but we just don't know what to do?
Yeah,
how do we turn the key?
Good. Well, let me say it this way. So when you talk to the people, kind of the muckety mucks that are leading the conferences and the climate conferences, all that, and I ask them, why don't you tell people that all this great stuff is happening, it's not enough, and right now we're predictably, it's not going to go well. And they say, and here's the response I get, we don't want to alarm people because if we freak them out, they'll be helpless, okay? We think freaking out is good because you'll move through it. It's like if somebody says, nobody wants to hear they have cancer. Nobody wants to hear that. But if you have cancer, right, you want to hear that. And you're going to freak out, but then you're going to find out, okay, once you're done freaking out, what can I do? So what we did was we actually, and this was in working with the people at the UN and, you know, people much smarter than me, scientists said, all right, we've got a 19 gigaton annual emissions gap to bridge by 2030. Okay, and as Tony said, that's about a 30% decrease, okay? So, and then we said, okay, well, can individuals do anything about that really, or is it really going to be up to the government and industry and all that? Well, the case that actual is if you break down the numbers, if 500 million people around the world take carbon-reducing actions, not huge actions, but like I'm not going to take my car today, I'm going to ride a bike, I'm not going to buy this, I'm not going to eat this hamburger, I'm going to have a salad instead, like simple things anybody can do, we can actually significantly bridge that gap. But the point is to get it out to people that who they think is handling it isn't handling it. That whatever kind of, you know, and it's just normal for people. Like you ask people on the street, what's your relationship to climate change? The number one response you get is, well, I know it's bad, but my gosh, it's too big and complex for me to get my hands around. So what I do
hold on a little bit because it's kind of introduced the audience to, there's also a third person on the line. So that person who hasn't spoken yet, do you want to say something or are you just listening? I'm not sure.
My name is Peter Goldmark. I don't know whether you're referring to me or not.
I don't recognize your voice. So good morning. Thanks for waiting.
Kezi.
Good morning.
Hi, Peter.
Kezi.
We can hear you.
Peter Goldmark is a very committed player in the climate crisis game, if you'd like to include him somewhere on the call.
Well, we are including him on the call.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, first of all, you should know, in case you're unfamiliar, all the lines are open, so we hear all of you, and the idea is, the difficulty sometimes is not stepping on one another, which is easily done. So I guess when we look at this, the complexity of all that you're doing, is how is it that people who are so intellectually infused and knowledgeable in different disciplines, how is it that we're not getting guidance from the top? Is it that they're ignorant or is this a political ploy? So what's missing in engaging people from the simplest individual to the most complex individual? And is business going to be a partner in trying to mitigate and ameliorate the problem of climate change, which is exponentially growing to such an extent that whoever told you that 5 years ago was already too late may actually be right? But we don't seem to feel the importance of moving ahead now.
Yes,
your
Peter, let me offer a couple of thoughts on that. First of all,
go ahead, please.
One thing we've all felt one way or another is that the climate change process, compared to how we as human beings live and experiencing, is slow. It's as if you went to the beach and somebody told you, relax, high tide isn't for 5 hours. So you're talking about things that for most of the past 30, 40 years were decades away. So it doesn't ring a bell with the human experience, which we evolved that when we passed something, if there was rustling in the bushes, that might be a danger for us. If there was a lightning bolt coming through the sky, you hop back or you react or you're scared. But this is something we now understand that scientists have documented, but it is coming slowly, and the job we got to do is tremendous. And we don't have many precedents for that. Now, here's the second thought. We have had a major failure of our leaders around the world. You can count on one hand the leaders of countries, of political parties, in self-government. You can count them on one hand, the ones who have tried to make this a big issue. The first report signed by a large group of serious scientists in the U.S. to an American president to say, watch out, you got a problem coming, was in 1965. We have done nothing. So none of our leaders have chosen to make this an issue. There are a number of reasons for that. One obvious one is a structural one. This isn't going to help you get elected. If you're talking about something 20, 30 years away, which would have been the case back then, and you got to run for office in 2 years or for a second half of a four-year term, this isn't going to help you. Well, now, as Laughlin and Tony and others have said, we're in the make-or-die decade. And now we need leaders who are going to say, hey, I'm going to go to the front, and I'm going to fight on this one. And that's what we've got to see if we can get.
From a political perspective, can we bring the divide, the political divide, together on this issue? Or is there something that also divides the nation on the crisis that is before us?
Hezzy, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you at every time.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, I'm a little slow on how things work. I want to redirect the conversation for a moment away from the leaders, because for Laughlin and I, that's part of the mythology that someone out there will take care of it. It is our premise that there's nobody out there who's going to take care of it. And the wishing for leaders to step up is wishing, waiting and hoping. And we're asserting that who's going to move the needle is the individuals getting in action. Out of that, leaders may emerge. But there is a spectatorship, a trance state we're in, thinking some great leader will step up. We think the leader's in us, in each one of us. And so I think Peter is right on about the decade, but the locus of power, we're not looking to the, quote, leaders. We're looking to the individuals to take a stand.
You're the only one that mentions that we're not looking for anybody. We're looking for the science. We're looking for the remedy. We're looking to know what we can do to change the equation. So if it means not eating beef, because of, the whole issue of raising cattle and other foods and going to a vegetarian diet or things like that, or moving forward with, automobiles and that are powered by, batteries and stuff like that. What do people do? We don't know what to do.
Yeah. 20,
that's the problem.
You may want to address this, but 2030 or bust exists to give people a platform for actions. We don't expect people to become saints, but we are clear that when people engage, things move.
Right on Peter's coattails a bit. Look, we absolutely, my gosh, it's going to make it. We are not here to at all discount the power that the political leaders have. And we think that the people that are working in that arena should work harder than ever in pushing that. All right. At the same time, the climate isn't waiting for the political leadership necessarily.
No,
all right.
Not.
So we have to be kind of working in the reality of the situation rather than, well, if we don't get the right leadership, we're screwed. So we hope we get that. We don't want to put all our eggs in that basket. We want to be working from, one of the things, for example, that we're going to be offering is in October, we're going to have our first what we call global climate update, where we want to offer every quarter to anybody that you don't have to be a scientist and anybody, you don't have to be a diplomat or a politician, but you can come. It's going to be an online offering, and you can come, and we're going to actually break down the 10-year game and where we are in that game, ahead or behind, and what are the actions that you as an individual can take that will make the biggest difference in getting us on track to winning this game in the next 10 years. Because what we find is that when people realize that they have a kind of power to take an action that has a global impact, when they realize they have that kind of power, then all of a sudden they start taking action. If you're walking around that what I do basically doesn't make any difference, you're not going to do anything. But if you've gotten enough of an education that you can see, wow, I didn't eat a hamburger. That saved 600 gallons of water. Wow, if 500 million of us didn't eat a hamburger, that saves as much Amazon rainforest land as there is in four times all of the land mass of all the boroughs of New York City. When I can start to connect my action with the global impact, all of a sudden, what I do today really matters. And that's what we really want to give people. Not we're empowering them, but give people the opportunity to empower themselves, that the actions that I take, the choices I make today, really are going to make the difference.
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, what I take away to some extent is that the fear and the knowledge that we are already, that is being shared across the world, evidently not driving us in the direction to change or ameliorate the problem. But the thing is, what are we going to do in 10 years? What can we do now to begin that 10-year process? Move in that direction. So I'm not asking you for the secrets, but because you're going to be doing this on a regular basis, informing people of what they can do. But have you been able to formulate concepts that will not undermine people, but will embolden them to think in that direction?
Yeah, we have. And you know, what we do is that we talk to people. So we go and we give presentations. We do one-on-one work. People can watch, come to our website and see our videos like that. But one of the things that in terms of our principles is to disabuse yourself of the myth that might be there, the number one being that somebody else is going to do this or that it isn't really that bad. And what we find is that when people get kind of out of what the assumptions that they've been living in and get into the reality of it, that everybody really does want to make a difference. And it's not that they're stupid or they're not committed or anything like that. It's just that they haven't seen a pathway for themselves to have their action make that kind of an impact. And when they see that pathway, which is what we provide, they start taking those actions. You know, we've got an app called the 2030 or Bust app that you can get on Google Play Store or at the Apple Store. And you go in and click the action that you took today, whether it's, you know, I rode my bike, I, you know, ate a salad, whatever the action that you take, your action that day, and it gives you your carbon budget. And then it also aggregates everybody else's budget so that you can see what's the impact that my action's happening. And we want to get the whole world in on this, in this game that we want to win in the next 10 years.
That sounds perfect. So in other words, you're showing people what they can do and how it will impact the environment. So there are solutions already, and what you're saying is that we're stuck under the belief that our elected officials or some other body is going to be able to bring us out of this funk that we're in. Is it a political crisis that we have, or do we need a scientific input?
Well, we call it a crisis of consciousness. And it's definitely, I mean, you can frame it as a political crisis. You can frame it as a, you know, the Pope has framed it as a moral crisis. You can frame it as a scientific crisis. But the what's going to make the difference is the actions that we take. The actions that we took got us into this mess, and it's going to be the actions that we take that get us out of it. And there's nothing political about action. You know, the glacier doesn't care if a Democrat or a Republican takes the action or if it's an, right? So our thing is that we're not political. We're not moral. That what matters is anybody can take the action, and that's what makes the difference. So, you know, that's how we work.
Well, okay, so if there are solutions, individual solutions in the process, how are we going to learn those different methodologies? Is that what you're promoting out
that's,
there?
Exactly. So what we've done is, we've worked with lots of other organizations like Drawdown and, you know, amazing, you know, people are out there that are doing amazing things. And, you know, Peter, and have the opportunity to be associated with Peter. And so we've just taken the actions that have the biggest carbon reducing impact and that are simple enough that anybody can do. Now, obviously, if you want to buy a Tesla, if you want to put solar panels, you know, amazing, wonderful, okay? Most people don't have that resource to do that, so that's not on the app. But, you know, certainly reducing your beef intake is probably the biggest and simplest thing that anybody can do. You know, more rainforest is destroyed for agricultural farming, industrial farming than for anything.
How do we contend with the economic debacle that this may befall, like a country like Brazil, where they spend so much money on raising cattle? They're clearing the forest in order to have grazing land. How do you contend with those needs? Because what do you do during that transition period to morph people from one sort of lifestyle to another that would be amenable to the environment? Otherwise, we're going to get sick one thing or another.
Yeah.
Can I come in on that, Buckland?
Absolutely, Tony, absolutely.
So, Hezzy, my daughter just got her PhD in anthropology from the University of New Mexico, and she has spent considerable time in Argentina studying the change from the gaucho culture to a soy culture. And there are impacts when you do that. But just to put this deforestation in perspective, for the most part, deforestation was there and the beef is relatively recent. So just, you know, countries switch their, you know, what are their strengths economically all the time. Our country's done it, Brazil's done it, Argentina's done it, and they do come through it. What our focus, you know, in other words, Brazil can find a way to be economically viable. I guarantee it. I addressed it specifically without having to rely on deforestation and beef. It would, you know, some things would have to move, but you got to remember, for the most part, it hasn't been beef. For the most part, beef is a, you know, X decades primary. Just like with Argentina, I would say the gaucho culture started going out 80s, 90s, the beginning of the century. It's pretty much out, and soy replaced it. So cultures can adjust, can adopt, can adapt. And we're focused on what the individual can do. You know, if there's no demand for beef, or demand drops, then the supply drops. It won't go there. I mean, what kept gas-guzzling, lead-emitting cars on the road was there was the demand for it. Once the demand shifted, then the emissions catalyzers came in and other things happened that responded. Same with tobacco and landmines. You know, there are things that are tolerated in one era, but then the next era is no longer willing to accept it, and the economy moves. So, you know, it takes something at an individual level and a macro level, but it's doable once we commit to it.
This is Peter. I'd like to add a little on Brazil because it's such an important example of what's going on in the world. What is going on in Brazil now, and the switch in Brazil from a country that was making some progress in saving its forests to a country that was destroying it and threatening climate, threatening water availability in California because the Amazon was being cut down. Mm. What kind of thing can you do about that? Mm. And
you've got to
show that the people have a voice, that they want their governments and leaders to be serious on these things. And I'm going to give you an example that ties some of this together. There are a couple of organizations putting together documented information which will be converted into an app for your cell phone that says when you go to a supermarket, if you want to buy this kind of meat, they chopped down the rainforest in Brazil to produce this kind of meat. And I think if you get that tool in the hands of young people, they're going to say, and as Tony just said, that makes a difference what the consumer wants. They're going to say, hell, I won't buy that kind of meat. Just a little example of the way you got to connect these different pieces, tools for the individual, clear choice. No, I won't buy beef that was raised because someone chopped down the trees that they're grazing the land on, and communicating it, me feeling I'm not alone. Hey, I'm going to send this app to 10 of my friends, and bingo, 10 of my friends will start doing the same thing.
So you're suggesting that will be the, I guess, the road towards some sort of amelioration over time, because right now a lot of countries are paying Brazil not to deforest their land, and so it's being accepted, but nothing being done to correct it. And big
correct.
Business.
Correct, they are deforesting. The new government is encouraging deforestation.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but they're also accepting money from the world to not to deforest, but they're not paying attention. Are the countries that are paying for, you know, to maintain the forest as it was in a pristine manner and even grow more, is this a mistake to even pay them these subsidies,
yes,
which are not being used correctly?
Yes, it is a mistake, and some of those countries are reconsidering whether to go on with those payments.
Uh-huh. Because the amount of money invested in Brazil, which is a failure, could be put towards something that would work, such as teaching people the conduct that they can engage, that they're conducive to changing towards.
That's right.
So that's very compelling. That's a great idea. And is there any leadership when it comes to environmental remediation?
In Brazil or generally?
Well, in general, because I don't think the Brazilians are doing it.
There are some actually groups in Brazil that are working on this. And I guess one of the things I feel is we need a broader, stronger kind of, and I like the idea, the way Laughlin put it, it should be the ultimate power has to come from the citizens involved. But we need citizens to start saying, hey, I'm not supporting any more leaders who are going to be totally quiet on this issue. I'm not going to do it.
It's both.
It's both the leaders and the individuals.
Right.
And what we want to do, Hezzy, is get the individual out of their head that the leader or knowledge alone will handle it. Knowledge produces knowledge. What makes a difference is action, and we want to wake up the train. See, when you asked earlier, are our leaders evil or something, it wasn't those words, Hezzy, but it was something like, you know, what's missing? Well, people are raised to think that if they're better informed, it has an impact in the world. That's not true. It's simply inaccurate. What has an impact in the world is action. And knowledge can inform action, can prompt action, but if you don't take action, nothing in the world happens.
Well, you're right about that. Except, you know, we could talk about this ad nauseum. The question is, what do we do? We don't have a book. We don't have a template to say, okay, not everybody's going to be a Greta Thunberg, but evidently her voice is silenced by a lack of change. Because she doesn't know how to transform her knowledge into engaging people in a manner where they too can have a part in this partnership for change. So that's the question. I'm not looking for your secrets. I'm just wondering, how do we get there?
Well, I think the answer, everyone would agree, is skateboarding. Okay? So we have this, we skated about 400 miles before the pandemic hit from Salt Lake City to Las Vegas and got lots of press, lots of coverage, lots of engagement. And so we're doing a bigger one now called the Skate of the Union, which we're going to start here at Labor Day in New York, and then we're skating different areas of the country for 2 months. And we're inviting other folks to come and skate. We've got people like Staples is getting involved now. Different sports companies are getting involved. Broadway Bomb, which is the biggest skate event in New York City, one of the biggest in the world, is now partnering with us. And we're out to get, in 2021, out to get 100,000 people to personally take the stand that they have something to do with ending the climate crisis, and they're going to get onto the field and start taking the action and telling people about it, just like Peter said. And if we can get 100,000 people in that kind of action and that kind of mindset by the end of 2021, we say we've got a shot for the kind of movement that we're out to create to get this 500 million. So that's our
strategy.
Okay,
well, that's a question. You mentioned even a supermarket chain that is going to be engaged
yep.
in this.
Yeah.
Is one of the difficulties for people, individuals, that when they see somebody of tremendous power in their field of endeavor, such as supermarket chains, do
yeah.
we abdicate too easily? Do we recognize that we need to maintain the impetus? What goes wrong in that dynamic? Are we all looking for mommy and daddy to take care of our problems?
Well, I think that's
we
pretty
all do.
Yeah, I think COVID is a great example, right? Is that human we're
uh-huh.
just not great early responders. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That oh, it's over in China, no need to worry. Oh, well, it's only in Washington, no need to worry. Oh, it's over. I mean, it's like, really? Right? But
yeah.
so as Peter said, I mean, it's pretty much your house has to literally start, you have to smell the smoke to say, wait a minute,
mm-hmm.
we better do something, right? And
mm-hmm.
The more we can get it to be immediate, even though my house right now isn't underwater, you know, which is part of the mindset that we're out to break up, which is, you know, that I live like other people in the world are just kind of somewhere else, and what I do doesn't really affect them, and what they do doesn't really affect me. And if we can start to get that mindset called what I do really does affect you and what you do really does affect me, that's what we're out to break
mm-hmm.
up. See, if people can discover for themselves the kind of power we have to handle this issue, we can go after anything that looks like it's too big or that we're waiting for somebody else.
In a sense, what I take away as well from some things that you've said is that if we change our behavior pattern, if we become more aware and sensitive to our impact on climate change, how do we move that equation forward and sustain it? So
yep.
that people recognize that what they did by not having a hamburger
yep.
is going to change the equation, and
yeah.
that therefore they need to maintain it for a year or two or five or 20
yeah.
and in
yeah.
order to bring us all together under one tent.
Yeah.
So how do we do that? And do we also need to eclipse some of the political situations where you're fighting one form of government as opposed to another? What do you do about a renegade government or country that says, well, we don't really care. Let them take care of it in the United States, and we'll do what we want, and we'll do whatever works for us. And is everything
yeah.
also monetarily based? What about the employment and positions and jobs? How do we marry all this?
Hey, I love that you're going for the one-size-fits-all answer, and you know, and I'm pulling for your intent there. But, Hedy, look, Lewis and Clark didn't have a map. The Wright brothers didn't have a map. Columbus, for all the havoc he caused, didn't have a map. One of the things Lachlan and I, and I believe Peter is as well, pointing to is that people, when they're confronted with no alternative, they get very ingenious. You know, when the Wright brothers said, we're going to Kitty Hawk, and we're going to be in that wind, and we're going to figure something out, something happens. Lewis and Clark, we're going to... So the thing you got to include is that people have the capacity to invent, to create, and that's what we're pulling on. Your questions are really great, and they're right on target, but nobody has one answer for all of them. What we're saying is human beings get confronted, they go to work, and we want to elevate the confront, and we want to take out the optionality, the hope and the wishing and the someday, one day, and we want to alter that space so people can say, hey, it's me. This is mine.
Well, I appreciate what you're saying because it makes all the sense in the world. So I'm looking for invention, but then I'm very worried about what we've created in our present day. And that is we've got false news, we've got fake news, we've got people proselytizing for one reason or another. And it's not one side, it's not the right, it's not the left, it's not the middle, it's not out there. How do we contend with all these dynamics that rob us of the capacity to change the dynamic of the future of humankind and life on this planet? Because I'm starting to say, well, is that the reason why we want to go explore if we can open up a new planet in Mars? Really?
Well,
is that our solution?
Let me just say this. Probably not going to be necessarily the answer you're looking for, but I remember this, and I think Tony, you actually were at this. We did an event at REI, the outdoor store, in big store in New York. We did an event there, and somebody in the back row, we did questions and answers, and he said, "Wow," he said, "I've been going to all these climate organizations, and I'm not sure which one to join up with. And you sound great, but then blah blah blah, And he said, "I just don't know if you're the ones that are going to make it happen, right?" And I said, well, first of all, we never said we are the ones or we have the answer. That's not what this is, okay? But I said, the other thing is that if you're going by predictability of success, we are definitely not the ones to go with, okay? So as one of our colleagues at the UN said, you've moved this from impossible to almost impossible because you actually have a model, okay? So we thought that was a good step.
Well, you have a roadmap.
We do. But you see, what we're out is to build this kind of army, if you want to say, of people who are standing for this in the face of all the circumstances, not waiting for the circumstances or have to figure out what the map looks like before they take the next action. So those people that are in a country where the politicians are against this or whatever like that, that's up to them to work out how they're going to deal with that. But we want them to have the power to do that rather than, since we have these political leaders, we can't do anything. That's what we're out to shift. And we're trusting that people's ingenuity when they're standing for something like, it's like if your house did catch on fire, you would work out what to do. You'd work it out, right? If your child is sick and has to get to the hospital, you'll work out where to go, how to get there. You're going to work that out. So people really can come up with some pretty amazing stuff when called on. And we say that's what's missing is that people just haven't called themselves on this. And that's what we're out for.
Well, how do we move people's mindset to a different equation so they come up with a different answer?
Well,
here's one example, Ed, and I'm going to have to leave this call pretty soon. So I want to. We need, building on what Laughlin said, one thing we need is some simple, spreadable tools. So an individual who does want to do something, does want to skateboard for a week, does want to give them a tool, and we haven't given people good tools. So that's why I use the example of this consumer campaign. Let's say I decide I'm going to boycott a store in my neighborhood because they're chopping the stuff they're getting and selling there. It's coming from chopping down the rainforest. And then suppose I can send that to 10 friends with one push on my laptop. And then suddenly they've got it. And I say, hey, suppose half of them start using it. Simple tool like that to start connecting us around these issues. That can be very powerful.
Yes.
And Hezzy, one of the purposes of 2030 is to provide a tool like that you can use on an app and that you can track with a community of people, akin to what Peter's pointing to with consumers. And I agree that we need simple tools that are spreadable, or in Peter's language. And it is our view that 2030 or bus.org is one of those key tools. And so we're for get the tools you need on your bench, but one bench that's simple and spreadable is 2030 or bust.org. So that's why we're promoting it. That's why we invented it. That's why we're funding it. That's why we're working at it, because we agree. We need simple tools that are spreadable, and we're offering one that has an impact.
Okay.
Gents, I want to thank you. I got to go get ready for another call. Thank you for
thank
a good
you,
conversation.
Peter, it was so great.
And thanks to all those who were listening to us, because those are the people that really count.
Absolutely.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Peter. Well, if I remember correctly, I'm trying to recollect, and it just came to mind, I think the company that owns the beef processing plant is called Odebrecht. It's based out of Brazil. How do we change their mindset from going from one focus in a business model to one that is going to be, respectful of the need for a climate change for the better, for our health and for our survival? How do you do that? Do we know? Will that actually rise from the bottom, from individuals doing what they need to do?
Yeah, I think so. You know, just one thing is, so first of all, the time when we can have this happen and it's not going to be disruptive or difficult is over. Okay?
Okay.
So it will be painful to make what has to happen over the next 10 years happen. And that's simply as a function of that we've waited this long. You know, like Peter said, if we started this in 1965, it wouldn't have been painful. It's now going to be painful. Okay, because we're going to have to make shifts that the economy isn't ready for. We're going to have to make shifts that industry isn't ready for, but that's just what you do when the house is on fire. You put it out, and then when it's over, but you don't do an economic study when your house is on fire. Okay? So, yeah. The other thing is
climate
that
climate change has informed us to some extent because of the heat that's causing about plants are dying where one time they were thriving. Now they're moving north because they need a temperate temperature. Fish are dying because it's too hot. Snails are frying in the water. You know, there's so many things that are happening. Will climate change, and as it changes, inform us to do something different? Is that going to be the impetus?
Well, it's certainly going to be part of it. And the other thing I wanted to say, and then I know you wanted to say something, Tony, is that the consumer has a huge impact. So if people stopped buying plastic, Pepsi would stop making plastic, like instantly, okay? Much faster than trying to get anti-plastic legislation passed. So we're huge fans of boycotts, like Peter was saying, directing consumers. One of the things that we're going to be doing on the tour is actually pointing out in different areas of the country, these people are actually on the side of ending the crisis. These people aren't. Buy this stuff. Don't buy this stuff. Absolutely makes a huge, huge impact, and the individuals can make that impact.
Okay. Well, that's very encouraging.
And what you're doing right now, see, look, what's going to influence the people in Brazil or anyone on this call is the conversations they participate in. So a boycott is an action taken out of conversations. This show is a conversation. If Lachlan and I get access to that meat-producing company in Brazil, we could at least begin the conversation. The unit of action is language. People start to talk, and as you talk, so you see. As you see, so you act. So we're missing the vocabularies and conversations that have people see, this is it, it is mine, it is now. This is it, it is mine, this is now. And as that conversation takes over, the actions go with it. So doing this call, Hezzy, is part of what influences who's producing beef in Brazil. And it's, you know, you could say it's indirect, but the degree that we can alter the public conversation, introduce new terms and tools, the actions will follow. They go right with it. They don't even follow. They move with it. So, I'm thanking you here, and I'm hoping this will be one of many conversations we can open up because we bring it to make it immediate. Yeah, no, really, it's just great. And Lachlan going on the skating tour is the same thing. and mobilizing, you know, the Tony Hawk Foundation and the skateboarders and this, mm-hmm. you know, climate crisis ending in its quote as an extreme sport. You know, you're introducing new conversations into how the public thinks and acts. That has the act shift.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, can we get these conversations in powerfully and rapidly enough to hit the target? See, by defining the actual gap and the target and creating a game, we now have a pathway. Instead of being inundated by information, it's very clear we've got to 2030 to reduce approximately one-third of the emissions globally. And we need to develop the tools and wherewithal, which means language and commitment, to do it.
Well, do you think the language will bring about the commitment? And how do we actually create the language that will be conducive to people's mindset based on the facts that they know? Because I don't know what is their impetus for doing anything at the moment. Some are, but very few in comparison to the population.
Their brain responds to all language.
Right.
Uh-huh.
The brain records everything real and imagined. And when you who was Justin Bieber? Justin Bieber created a language called Justin Bieber. So did Eminem. Mm-hmm. You know, you can go right on down. You know, the woman who just did Biles, is that how you say her name? The Simone, the acrobatist, her language was moving her body.
Biles.
Yeah.
But see, that's a language. Yeah. It's all mm-hmm. a form of communication. Anytime you can see something, oh, that's a thing, that's a language.
Yeah.
And, you know, avionics is and aeronautics is a language. Radio mm-hmm. is a language. Politics is a language, believe it or not.
Yeah. I
do believe it.
And it really also gets it, you know, like if you look at, you know, when what happened with smoking, it used to be really sexy to smoke.
Right.
And now, oh, my God, it's dirty. It's stupid. It's like it's totally turned around. Right. So
correct,
and there was the anti-smoking campaign because people, you know, we compare ourselves to other campaigns. We've lived lots of people mm-hmm. that worked on other campaigns. Yes, that was one of the biggest campaigns ever in terms of shifting people's relationship to something. And it went from sexy to dirty. Okay. And mm-hmm. that it's a matter of getting that, you know, we need to be working with major ad campaigns. This has got to be like, get this out there. All of a sudden they get into somebody's head. Wow. Every hamburger, 600 gallons of water, this much rainforest
mm-hmm.
taken out. Get those kind of, we want to get those posters up, you know, McDonald's and whatever, places like that. But you get that into people's brain cells, public service announcements, marketing campaigns,
mm-hmm.
you know, rock groups that are out there doing their tours that they say, good, take out your phone and download the app. Boom, we got 10,000 people. It's got to be
mm-hmm.
major, and it's got to hit, and it's got to be consistent. I forget what the study is, something like people have to hear something seven times before they hear it. I don't know what something like that. And so we just like, you know, it's the messaging has got to be clear, simple, concise, and steady.
Okay. That's very
with
encouraging.
With the heading one being, you can end the climate crisis. You can end the climate
mm-hmm.
crisis.
So it's up to you, as they say.
It's not just an adage. It literally is, Hezzy.
Yes.
Look, mm-hmm. my wife's from Vermont, and they had a bunch of people in the early 90s who were just horrified by the children's legs being blown off by landmines in certain parts of Asia and other places.
Mm-hmm.
They're just, you know, shocked. They got in action, and in about 10, 11 years, they got 95% of the country's signatories to the non-production and non-proliferation of landmines. And these were eight people, Vermont, and they won the Nobel Prize in about 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, what the hell is that? That's people
well,
taking
it's,
a stand.
Well, it's grassroots. It's people who are aware and knowledgeable. And I forgot now her name. It escapes me. The princess that married the future king of England who died. I can't believe I forgot it. It's her children that are, you know, the princes of England.
Princess Di.
But the thing is, she was very instrumental in in promoting the digging up of mines, and she put it on the map.
Yep. And if you get celebrities, man, they count.
Yeah.
But what you're doing, Hezzy, I just salute you. The public conversation is the public conversation. So what are the media means of reaching the town square where people can talk and look and wonder and question and take action? And so,
right.
you know, we're that's what the skate of the union is about, is to draw attention, and we're calling media along the way to call attention to 2030 or bust, because that's how it begins to take hold. It enters the conversation. Pictures, words, movements, events, all creates the conversation. Just like DWI, it's the same process. The problem with this is everything's at stake, and there ain't very much time.
No, there isn't. And too many
this
people are getting killed
of whack.
Because of DWI.
Yeah.
So do you think at the end of the day it's just a question of proselytizing these concepts so that they hopefully connect with people and they say, yeah, that's a great idea, and I have a hand in changing the equation?
Absolutely.
Or is it the fear of dying that's going to cause us to make that change? What does it take?
We'll take either one. So if it results in action, we're all for it. Okay. So I think
well,
there's a nice dance between
die,
the two.
That'll scare the bejesus out of everybody.
I don't know.
Look, Hezzy, fear comes and goes. It's a passing state.
Yeah.
Fear can be healthy as well.
Yeah.
Help yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I used to ski pretty out there, and I'm telling you, fear kept me alive. Because I'd see something coming up, and I'd have a moment of fear, and I'd correct course.
Yeah.
Fear is good. You know, you don't stay in it. You know, you go through it, and people have to go through something to confront, hey, wait a minute, this is the whole game. And it's now, and it's me.
Yeah.
It's a state change, but our view is, Lachlan and I think we can take people through it in a two-hour phone call.
Yeah.
The whole thing, the upset, the sadness, the anger, the rage, the disgust, the fear, it's a state. And once you get on the other side of it, you're good.
Yeah. And our preference is that people are left with the power of this is the difference I can make, rather than I'm terrified and semi-paralyzed, but I'm still going to do this, right?
So they're inspired.
Well, unfortunately, we're down to like about 90 seconds. Can you tell us how people can find out more about what you do and how they can become engaged?
Great. Go to the website. It's as Tony said, it's 2030orbust.org. That's our website.
Okay.
And then you'll see there are opportunities to take action. There's a specific page we have now called Join the Tour. So you can come out and specifically you can join our skateboard tour. You can be a sponsor, one of our sponsors to fund the tour. You can pick a city where we're going to be and let us know that you want to come skate with us, and we can meet up with you there. If you want to host an event in your city, you can do that. Lots and lots of ways to participate, but 2030orbust.org is the place to go. We also have a Facebook page. 2030orbust also is our Facebook page.
That's beautiful. Well, gentlemen, I hope you'll consider coming back. I hope I haven't freaked you out.
I loved it.
Waiting you from coming back.
Now, your questions are amazing, so thank you.
Yeah, you're a great host, Hezzy. really.
Yeah,
you really,
really.
Committed
Very
human
much.
Being. You're really
Thank
committed.
You. All the best
bright.
For you guys, gentlemen.
Okay.
It was a pleasure. Thank
we'll
you for making
touch.
The time for our audience. All
right.
The best.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
You. Okay.
Well, thank
yeah.
you.
Bye.
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 Well, there
Bye-bye.
We are. We're under 10 seconds. We'll say goodbye because we don't have another choice. And there we are. Have a great day, folks. Goodbye.